This episode is sponsored by Indeed. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes of this show, booking guests across time zones, tight turnaround edits, and constant time management. And when things get chaotic, you realize pretty quickly how important it is to have the right person on your team. If I had to hire someone tomorrow, I wouldn't just want a good editor. I'd want someone who understands pace in long-form interviews and can work fast under pressure. And in moments like that, you think, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Because Indeed sponsored jobs boost your listing in search results, helping you reach the candidates with the specific skills and experience you actually need. And it works. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's a serious edge when the pressure's on. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
You're up, we're up, it's the perfect match. Now it's on you to make the right decision while you're scrolling in bed. Head to 7-Eleven and grab a delicious chicken sandwich with 7 rewards at 7-Eleven. Crispy, craveable, and way better than settling for the same old, same old. It's available at 7-Eleven and just $4 with 7 rewards. Visit your local Columbus 7-Eleven and satisfy that craving today. Valid through 6/23/26. Stopping sold separately while supplies last. Participating stores, see app for full terms.
I'm certainly fast. I'm committed. I certainly have some of my dad's DNA in me. There was a lot of the determination of doing him proud, doing myself proud, and doing my team proud, because every time I was in a racing car, I was always depending on somebody making that happen. This I never forget.
Fast? Definitely. A winner? Repeatedly. In the 1990s, Tom Christensen seemed destined for Formula One.
They were interested in me and they offered me half a season. My mom and family always said, if you risk too much, don't do it. And I think I was a little bit not ruthless enough, I would say, because many people would say I should have done it.
It never happened. Instead, he stood on other podiums, including the top step at the Le Mans 24 Hours, a record 9 times. I'm Tom Clarkson, and this F1 Beyond the Grid is about what might have been for Tom Christensen. How he was on the same path as Michael Schumacher. The times he came close to an F1 drive, the risky offer he wasn't willing to take, and why he was so successful in sports cars. And Tom talks about the day he impressed a world champion in a modern F1 car. Tom, it's great to have you on the show. How are you?
Very good and happy to be here, Tom.
Well, you're known as Mr. Le Mans, and rightly so after your 9 victories there. But can we start by talking about Formula One? And my first question to you is, how much would you like to be out there now doing battle with the likes of Verstappen, Alonso, Hamilton?
Of course you would love that. In generally, my dream and ambition as a very young was always going towards Formula One, no doubt. But seeing how well it's going today. Formula One has grown, all the drivers, all the teams. It's really fascinating seeing how many followers there is around the world. And I think Stefano and his team are doing a a fabulous job. But yes, the racing, the core racing, being in the cars, that's what you will always have as a racing driver. But I'm a little bit over my birth certificate for that now, to be realistic.
But TK, I want to take you back to the 90s, okay? Because I remember back then headlines saying that you were the best driver not to be racing in Formula One. Do you remember those headlines?
Yes, and I absolutely was very happy about that, to be seen as the best not to have started in a Grand Prix in a way. But my career was always parallel. Like the whole ecosystem, I believe, is a little bit parallel. Formula One has grown tremendously over these years, and so has sports cars as well, and the whole racing community in many ways. But there was a lot of links to Formula One. There was several testing, but I always stayed around the sports car racing, and that was my path.
Was it the case of right talent, wrong time for you? Because you won the German Formula 3 championship in 91. Schumacher won that championship the year before, and look what happened to him. What happened to you as the German Formula 3 champion? Were there lots of offers from F1 teams?
Not a lot of offers. When I won the German F3, there was more or less going towards Formula 3000. But it was very inspirational about Schumacher Häkkinen. I beat their lap record at Hockenheim the following year when they had their great battle in Formula 3. So I was very inspired by all that. But I went to Japan. I stayed several years in Japan, driving all kinds of cars in Japan. And I owe a lot to Japan about the whole thing, education of life, I believe. I really love Japan, but it was also a step away from Formula One, even though I was linked to several kind of opportunities. But it's a different time. I didn't have any budget at all. I'm kind of trying to be a modest boy, but I'm certainly from humble background, born on a gas station in Hobro, Denmark. My dad was a racing driver, a hard one, particularly in touring cars or even rallycross, things like that. As he always said, don't hit the others, but touching is fine. And that was kind of always the commitment I went into racing with. My time in Japan was fascinating, but just touching on Schumacher, I believe we were a little bit parallel in the way of he really did well in Formula One. And at the same time, I was part of winning teams in sports car racing. So in that sense, I have been very inspired of having more or less the same generation as Michael.
Because there wasn't, TK, there wasn't the amount of young driver academies back then. I mean, Schumacher actually was part of the first one with Mercedes. But were F1 teams back then reaching out for young people to take through to F1 in the way that Mercedes were?
No, I love what the academies are doing now. Looking, I mean, it's very hard. If you're really a strong driver, it's very hard to be overlooked by the academies today. Back then, it was a little bit more, let's say, the F1 world was... First time I went into the F1 paddock, it was on my CIK, FIA, super license for karting. That took me everywhere in Hockenheim. And you can know, even in Hockenheim, being very strict with the with a ticket to get into the paddock. But there I was just having my go-kart license, and I went in and I talked to several teams already in those years. But I would say who was very good at motivating young drivers, that was Eddie Jordan. Eddie was always telling me he needs me, and at one point it will happen. But of course, there was always money involved, which I never had. But it was also a motivating factor. So I would say him and his team was probably the one reaching out the most. Then later over the years, not speaking chronologically, I was testing for Minardi in the winter in Barcelona a few times.
What era are we talking now?
Now we are talking, must be 97, I think. Maybe 96, 97, something like that. 98, maybe.
I remember interviewing Esteban Tuero, who was a Minardi driver in 98.
Yeah, I tested with Luca Badoa at that time. But I had just signed with Honda in Super Touring and BMW for Le Mans. So it must have been 97, 98.
But Tom, if you'd already signed for BMW at Le Mans, why did Minardi put you in the F1 car?
Yeah, they were interested in me and they offered me half a season. But half a season, and then I'm a little bit more, you know, I'm an educated bank clerk, actually. So my mom and family always said, if if you risk too much, don't do it. And I think I was a little bit not ruthless enough, I would say, because many people would say I should have done it. And then have half a season and see what happens after half a year where I should sign, I would bring. I think at that time it was in the region of a little bit below $2 million.
Where were you going to find $2 million though?
Yeah, I couldn't, but so I mean, I kindly declined, did Super Touring, went to Le Mans with BMW, had two fantastic years with them. My biggest near miss was actually 99 with BMW, where all the manufacturers were there. The race of the century, and we were leading by 3.5 laps with Müller and Lehto. When we a few hours to the end, we retired. We were still leading 17 minutes after that. So that was a hard blow. But good things happened later that year. It was testing for Williams.
Were you part of the conversation when BMW were coming into F1 with Williams in 2000?
I was never at any, let's say, meeting in that sense, but I knew from as Williams were building the chassis for the Le Mans cars for BMW. I speak very fondly at that time with Patrick Head, there was John Russell. Those guys were very much in favor of me, and that call that when Frank called me, and hey, Christensen, I need you to test the FW 21 at Magny-Cours. Can you make it free for us? It will be lovely. Things like that just stays in memories. He was the one who was very close to have given me the chance back then. But Williams were the team in the 90s, and then it was they had this dip in the end of the 90s. Obviously, this was now with a. Later on, they were with a Megachrome deal when I was testing. And then with BMW, they came in. Michelin came in. A lot of things were good. Michelin was pushing me. Michelin was going in with the Groove tires. And I was doing a lot of testing there with them and their chassis. So I would say in those years, if I had had better funding management, clearly I would have been in. But there was a lot of drivers around. Montoya, Ralf Schumacher, Junquera. Jenson Button. So it was obviously on the other side also tough competition. But that was where I think it could have been in one of these meetings, could have gone one way or the other.
This episode is sponsored by Lisa. Some of you might remember me saying that I was finally planning to replace the mattress we'd had for more years than I care to count. Well, I'm pleased to say that the day has arrived. We've swapped it out for a Sapira Hybrid from Lisa. And after sleeping on it for a few weeks now, I can safely say I made the right choice. It's funny because I don't think I'd ever actually realized how much our old mattress was affecting my sleep. The Sapira Hybrid has just the right balance of support from the springs and comfort from the memory foam that from the very first night, I slept right through and woke up feeling more refreshed than I had in a long time. The only downside is that I don't actually get to sleep in it every single night. And it was easy to narrow down what I needed by using their online sleep quiz. It asks about things like your sleep position, preferred firmness, and the sort of support that you need. Then it gives you tailored recommendations all in less than 2 minutes. Lisa mattresses are designed and assembled in the USA, and they've even been awarded Best Hybrid and Best Memory Foam Mattresses by the New York Times Wirecutter. Plus, they make the whole process really straightforward with free shipping, easy returns, and a 120-night sleep trial. So go to lisa.com for 25% off select mattresses, plus get an extra $50 off with the promo code GRID, exclusive for our listeners. That's Lisa, LEESA.com. Promo code GRID for 25% off select mattresses, plus an extra $50 off. Support our show and let them know we sent you after checkout. Lisa.com, promo code GRID. This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. One of my favorite things to do on a race weekend is when I get the time to run the track before everything kicks into gear. I pretty much run every Thursday evening of a race weekend, and I try Fridays too, depending on what's going on. George Russell and Alex Albon are often out at the same time, as are James Vowles, Alan Permain, and other team principals. And Liquid IV's Hydration Multiplier Sugar-Free Sachets are the first thing I reach for because their science-backed formula with an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients are a great way to help me stay hydrated and refreshed during a busy race weekend, especially at some of the hotter destinations on the calendar, like in Barcelona last weekend. Because no matter what sun-drenched activities get you moving, you need to stay hydrated when things heat up. Liquid IV delivers longer-lasting hydration than water alone, and right now, you can get 20% off your first order with the code GRID at checkout. And the individual sachets are so convenient. Just slip one in your gym bag, backpack, or even in your pocket, and one stick mixed in 16 ounces of water can help keep you hydrated for up to 4 hours. I'm working my way through a box of the white peach flavor at the moment, but there are loads of sugar-free options to choose from, like rainbow sherbet and strawberry watermelon, so why not mix it up a little bit? Get moving with superior hydration from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first purchase with the code GRID at checkout. That's 20% off your first purchase with the code GRID at liquidiv.com. Can you tell us about that Williams test at Manicourt? What was the car like to drive? How did you get on in the groove tyres? I mean, Zanardi had come over from America and struggled with the groove tyres. How did you find it?
The first test there was actually when Zanardi, I think they had decided that he should not continue, the great man. And then I was testing there in Manicourt between the races in the East, I think before the Japanese Grand Prix. I had it okay with the groove tires, but nobody was a fan of them. So obviously with Michelin, what we were trying to do was particularly of nursing out that sensation of one or two very good laps. And then they would normally grain and you will drop off and lose lap time before you would, then it will clean up and you will come back. That was more or less what it was all about, particularly at the fronts, obviously. So they had their disadvantages, but there was clearly a mission for Michelin and from me testing. Actually, it was overseen by Pascal Vasselon in those days, and we got on pretty well. And I think at the end of the day, Michelin did a great job when they were in Formula One with a difficult regulation change to kind of slow down the cars a little bit.
Tell us about the Michelin testing that you did. What chassis were they? What car were you driving?
I was driving a white Williams chassis. So obviously that was, FW21. There was a bibendum on it, and we were testing on circuits, free testing, where there was only marshals and an ambulance and then us as a team, so kind of secret. Car was brilliant. They were, 560 kilos?
Yeah, back then. V10.
Yeah. They were just every brake, lunch brake particularly, they would change the engine. They used engines. This is in year 2000. They used engines from the team was already having at the Grand Prix, which had some mileage left. And I can believe and tell you, they went below a mileage of 400 kilometers. So you can see sometimes they were going down to about 350 kilometers. Then they would go for a renovation. So obviously they had an engine with 180 kilometers left. And they will put it in and I would go, they would say, all right, you will go for a long run with these three sets. And Michelin wanted to do 3x20 laps. And engine people would say, can we cut that to 15 laps each? And then they will make an agreement of maybe 18 laps. And of course, on the third stint, it could happen. It was three times, free spirit. Engineers were pushing limits beyond. And with these cars being so agile, so light, it was a fantastic time. And I've just been, just thinking about it, that was a really, really good time to have entered Formula One. And I would love to have done it because it became a bit more, like I was in sports car racing, the top speeds were the same, the braking points, things like that in the G-forces were pretty similar to Le Mans because Le Mans was free spirit as well. But in the slower corners where you, F1 car there with that light body mass was, was really inspiring to drive.
What a great opportunity for a young driver like you at the time, though, to be doing all that testing for Michelin. How much did the tires evolve in the time that you were testing?
That was all about the groove tires. So they evolved, definitely. There was also free spirit, a little bit about the, let's say, the rubber, which was being kind of used. Because remember, it was a competition. I mean, what it was all about was there was a Michelin team, and there was the Bridgestone teams, and Goodyear had just left. So the whole environment was about who would match up to have the right tire manufacturer at times. And what was good was Ferrari, as you remember, very exclusive with Mercedes at times, with Bridgestone. So they had to prove their way in. And that was particularly done with Williams, with Jaguar as well, where I also tested. Because what happened that year when I was testing with Michelin was I had just won some races with BMW, but I had switched to Audi. I have done the switch to Audi, which, of course, in German terms, would at one stage, I think Gerhard Berger, Mario Tyson, the great guys, they thought, all right, I think we need to let Tom go because he has gone to the other side.
Did you know by going to Audi that you were letting that opportunity go?
Yeah, I probably did, because that should have happened that winter. So in that sense, I thought I would look for an opportunity. I remember, I mean, Gerhard will tell me now, he's a little bit laughing, because back then he said, are you crazy? You're going Audi. We were driving in circles around Audi. And I said, I had a good feeling. I was honest with him. I said, I went to Audi and I met Dr. Ulrich. He showed me the humble facility back then up near Ingolstadt, and he showed me a drawing of the car, and it was very inspiring. So I signed, and then that following year we in Sebring, BMW was still there, but kind of just for the American Le Mans series, and we were driving in circles around BMW.
TK, we're going to get on to the sports car era in a moment. There's one other thing I wanted to ask you about. Was a couple of years ago, Zak Brown put you in the TPC McLaren at the Red Bull Ring, July 24, I think, wasn't it?
No, September 3rd.
It was September, was it?
The day, yeah. But I think in July I was in the sim at the Woking, yeah, doing the seat.
Can you just tell us about the whole process and how Formula One had changed between the 90s and 2024?
Zak Brown, he more or less on the spot, actually during a live interview or shortly after, it was a little bit like, Tom, when were you last in an F1 cockpit? And I started to look and count back, and I said, ooh, that's many years ago. And I said, we need to change that. And off he went. And then sometimes later that winter, because this was in Abu Dhabi, then I think in January, there was an email to me, Paul James and a few other people from McLaren on it. And then he set it up and made it happen. I chose later in the year. I think there was kind of options around, I believe, Silverstone and Red Bull Ring. So he already made sure, which he said to me, some tough circuits because I need to test it in the toughest possible way. And then I think Paul James said, okay, that's going to be Red Bull Ring, especially Sector 2 and Sector 3. And then it was planned. I went to Woking in July, doing the seat fitting, doing some sim work with the team.
Can we break that down? Is the seat position in a Formula One car different to a sports car?
Not a lot. Not a lot. I think actually you sit a little bit more upright in the Formula One car today than you did back in the early noughties. But you are laying down a little bit more in a Formula One car. Of course, it's certainly more cramped. And actually, it's a bit more perfected around you because a prototype, it is a two-seater in a way. So you are never depending on its right or left-hand drive. You normally, there's always one corner side where you are a little bit less supported. Where in a Formula car, everything is built around just you.
And what about the sim? Did you use sims back in the day?
Not really. We did, towards the end of my career, we started to have to do a little bit of sim, and where we actually used McLaren initially as a partner. So we were there a few times, and I think a few of the drivers Magnish including, where we asked where was the closest toilet, because of the kind of the drive sickness, the sea, what do you call it?
Motion sickness.
Yeah, so we asked about the where the toilet was, because motion sickness was certainly also in play. But we didn't use a lot of simulators.
How did you find the McLaren one?
I think McLaren was early on. They were probably a little bit ahead in the game back then. But when I came in July now for testing this car, you could already feel in the sim that I would say what is kind of the topic which is already been worked on. That's the inertia of a car. So the weight of a Formula One car for me is the main thing which has, or hopefully will come down in future as well. And 2026, we are already 30 kilos lighter than the year. So the trend is changed, and I think we should all applaud that. And certainly for the driving, you get a lot better feel out of a car, kind of the lighter it is.
But how well prepared were you for the real driving at the Red Bull Ring because of the simulator?
I trained a little bit up to it. Then I came in the simulator, and I think I was in it three times. The first time, I think Paul James was a little bit worried, because I believe one of these crash I had, I think I went off two or three times in the first run in the morning. And one of them, I think, would have totaled the McLaren TPC car. Then I had another one, which was not bad.
What happened, TK?
What happened? I think one was I got on the curb. Another one, I just got on the throttle earlier. And another one, I was braking too late. I think these were kind of the things.
Is that because you were struggling with the feel of the sim? Or just were you just exploring the limits?
Yeah, probably that. And then just when you... I've not been a professional racing driver in 10 years. So, you know, I love going to Goodwood. I love going to these things, more historic racing. Once in a while, Audi puts me in a good car for demo or something like that. But when you're out, you are not in sync with the speed of a racing driver. So, but I was committed, and I think that's what they could see. So the team helped me. So in the second run, it was pretty okay. Then we had lunch, then up, checked the seat again, as they have been, as that was the first thing I did, jump in the car. And then later in the afternoon, I forgot which seat. I think I used Lando's seat.
But hang on, you couldn't
it's true.
Fit. Yeah. You and Lando can fit in the same seat.
Ask Paul James, but it did. And I just needed the pedals a little bit changed. And then I didn't need the support they had on the sides, because obviously I am larger now than
I used to
be.
Well, no, that's my point, is that you in your 50s are sitting in the same seat as Lando Norris in his...
Yeah, and I was also... I said the same. I said, I can't be in his seat. And then, trust me, they said, he's larger than you think in some ways.
So take us to the Red Bull Ring now. Just the whole process of pulling out of the pit lane for the first time. How did it feel? And, you know, don't be modest. How were the lap times?
Yeah, I mean, modest. I mean, the thing was, the third time after the lunch, I was in the sim. And I was just 9/10 off the sim drivers, who are probably faster than the racing drivers at McLaren. And they were quite impressed. But I remember, God bless Paul James, when we went out. I mean, he said, Tom, it's fantastic. We have you. You should really enjoy it. And enjoyed it's a good opportunity for you as well. So kind of telling me, calm down, man. you're in proper equipment here. So yes, he probably felt I was a little bit too committed. So when we later went, this was end of July. So in beginning of September, we went to Red Bull Ring. I had the opportunity of seeing another driver having his first test, spending most of the day, which was kind of the proper test, obviously, a certain driver.
Well, wasn't that Gabriel Bortoletto?
You mentioned it.
Yeah, no, because he was part of the McLaren Young Driver Program back then. Yeah,
and he had his first test, and he was there doing all morning, doing the most part of the afternoon, and then around 3 p.m. They swapped, and I got in the car and had my two, I think it was five laps, and then a break, and then six laps. And that's what I had on one set of soft tires. And it was absolutely brilliant. And I will always remember Zach asking me so late. It's kind of made a full circle. It was good. It's fast.
What surprised you about the car?
To be in sync with the braking. And I just trusted completely the sim. So I would say that's when I was bravest, particularly down to what you call turn four, as it's downhill. And basically, one time you log off, you are off in the gravel. That was kind of the toughest in that sense. Physically, it was clearly turn nine. Over the crest, right-hander. I mean, different laps, you will see Lando and Oscar doing in sixth gear, on seventh gear, even in seventh gear at times. So that's fast. And that's barely a little lift. You're flirting with 6G. And, you know, when you have not been in a racing car for 10 years, it felt like my flesh, my whole body flesh was smashed up against the monocoque on the left-hand side. And it was simply just my bones, teeth sticking together, and the commitment trying to match that going through that corner and without putting a foot wrong. On top of that, thinking about Paul James and Zach Brown not doing any damage. But that was where there was the biggest offset through that corner. But in generally, I mean, I was within the fastest laps towards the end when the tires run out was around a couple of seconds. So it was, I think it was really good. I mean, what was very nice was this was September 3rd. When was Austin? I was in Austin sitting in with the Viaplay team because they had done a nice feature around that, which is still running on Viaplay on the test. We were sitting on a barbecue house and having these famous ribs or steaks in Austin. And suddenly, as I'm grabbing some fries, I get a knock from the back and there's a few people and one standing with a hat, or let's say a woolly hat, something like that.
Austin, it's normally quite hot there.
Yeah, it's quite hot. And then he goes, "Hey, you want my seat? Or well done on the test." That was Lando. He had his he was there with his engineer and maybe the chief mechanic and his trainer. They were there just having a taste as well. But that was nice.
I actually spoke to the team about it, TK. They were very impressed. Look, final question about driving that McLaren in 24 is, tell us about downforce, all right? Because those cars, under the last regulation set, there was so much ground effect being produced. When you're going through turn nine, the quick corner at the Red Bull Ring, how much of it is feel that you're getting through your bum, through the pedals, through your hands? And how much of it is just believing in the data that the car will do it? Slightly blind trust, if you like.
There's no doubt that it's blind trust was needed, particularly these ground effect cars. Not sheer commitment, because then you could overdrive it. And then if you push too much and you get, you know, any turbulence, any bouncing in the car could really generate the offset suddenly, and these snap, what we have seen, which looks from the outside kind of, what are you doing? But these cars were very critical. And I can see already now, shorter wheelbase, narrower track, they are looking much better and nimble, and with the weight lower. The more you go on that, there will be a much more benefit for the feel of the drivers. But I have to say that McLaren, the brakes, wow, they were spot on. The gearbox, in sync with the gears, and down changing, everything in that sense was perfect. And you're guided out, you know, just with the engineer in terms of warming the tires. But basically for me, it was, I just had to get on with it. I knew every lap was running into being the final. So I just went on with it. DRS was also tough. There's a very complex in terms of everything on the steering wheel. And there's a lot of things which you have to optimize with a modern Formula One car. It's a bit like in Le Mans, but there you have more or less more straights, or even in the sports car races, to do it. So I would say modern F1 car, very complex. Everything really sensational in the way of feel, the feedback from the car. It was an awesome, awesome experience. Just have to make them lighter, please.
This episode is sponsored by Shopify. One thing that always strikes me about starting something new is how quickly you realize you're suddenly responsible for absolutely everything. Whether it's launching a business or a side project, you begin by thinking about the exciting part. Next thing you know, you're dealing with websites, marketing, customer emails, payments, and 100 other jobs you didn't even know existed. That's why having the right tools around you can make such a difference. That tool is Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, from global brands like Heinz and Mattel to those just getting started. Shopify makes it easy to build a professional online store with hundreds of ready-to-use templates. And its AI tools take a lot of the heavy lifting off your plate, helping write product descriptions, create page headlines, and enhance your images. It also helps you reach new customers with easy-to-run email and social media campaigns, so you can spend less time worrying about marketing and more time focusing on your business. And perhaps best of all, Shopify brings so many important tasks together in one place, from inventory and payments to analytics and more. Start your business today with the industry's best business partner, Shopify, and start hearing. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/beyondthegrid. Go to shopify.com/beyondthegrid. That's shopify.com/beyondthegrid. This episode is sponsored by Vanta. What's the one thing in business that's spreading as fast as AI? AI risk. Because every new tool your team signs up for, every vendor that turns on AI features, every new integration, each one is an opportunity for something to go wrong. And most security programs weren't built for AI's pace of growth. And that's where Vanta can help. Vanta is the number one agentic trust platform used by over 16,000 fast-moving companies like Nando's and Granola to ensure they're always audit ready. And now Vanta is helping companies like yours watch for the risks that show up between audits across your vendors, your AI tools, and your whole environment. The Vanta agent works like a 24/7 GRC engineer in the background, finding issues, drafting fixes for you, and cutting vendor assessment time by up to 50%. Whether you're a fast-growing startup or a global enterprise, Vanta is here to help you automate your security and compliance and earn and prove trust. Get started today at vanta.com/grid. That's vanta.com/grid. Well, what that TPC run proved is something that people who follow the sport closely have known for many years, is that, you know, you coulda, shoulda, woulda been in Formula One and would have been very successful. But where you found all of your success was in sports cars. Let's talk about that now. What made you so good? What made you so effective as a sports car driver?
I don't know. I certainly have some of my dad's DNA in me. He was... there was a lot of the determination, of persistence, of doing him proud, doing myself proud, and doing my team proud. Because every time I was in a racing car, I was always depending on somebody making that happen. This I never forget. And this I certainly also felt I learned also in the times in Japan. But it was a certain Bertram Schäfer who actually took me out of the bank clerk situation, which I've just been educated as long as I had 1,000 days where I was just jumping from a small seat one time, go-kart, sometimes a Formula 2000, then an Opel Lotus race, then an old Formula 3 race, something like that. But Bert Schäfer called me in February 1991, join, sign, Volkswagen F3 driver, and off I went. I won my first race in Zolder, won the championship, and since then I was a professional racing driver until I called it off with Audi now more than 10 years ago.
Yeah, but specifically to talk about sports cars, your record at Le Mans, but not only at Le Mans, at Sebring, all of the great sports car races, you've been there, done it. Why? I don't believe it's a coincidence. You must have been doing something special in the car.
I'm certainly fast. I'm committed. I am looking at the efficiency in it. I'm not necessarily want to win next corner. I'm always thinking about more stint time than lap times. But still, it comes from from being determined, I think. I mean, I think I joined with Stefan Johansson, Mikel Alboreto, the way they embraced me, particularly Mikel, as he knew the car better. You know, there was no data at all. I mean, there was no sim or anything. I come to Le Mans, I don't know the circuit at all. So Mikel and me, we go on a scooter and we talk a little bit about it. At the end of the day, in the night, we're starting to see dawn approaching. And they asked me for an extra stint and I do a lap record at that time. And then since then, it was obviously a very good camaraderie. With the way I was dealt in with the team, with those two drivers, that was for sure the fundament. And the way they did that...
You're talking about 97, aren't you? When you were parachuted in to that team at the last minute because Davy Jones couldn't make the race at the last minute. And, you delivered and then suddenly your reputation sort of stood you well for the next few years, right?
Yeah, it's very much the way you're embraced by the team. You know, the German mechanics speaking in dialects. There was only 12 mechanics. It was a one-car team, Reinhold Joost. But Michele and Stefan were very good at embracing me there for my debut. They gave me confidence instead of, you know, you could always, they have a young driver coming in, supporting them. We have never met before. And all this happens literally during the week up to Le Mans. And I think all that I always took with me further on, because I've had 16 different teammates over 18 starts at Le Mans. And I think what we have had together was important when the teammates became young towards the end of my career. I was always thinking in a way of how they embraced me. That's how you have, because you are, I'm not saying you always have to look out and be comfortable, everyone. There should be no weak link. And if there's a weak link, that should be the focus. And weak link means sometimes if you're not confident. It could be myself at times with certain situations. I mean, you know some of my teammates. I can mention them very fast if you want. But 18 starts, 14 times we arrived to the finish, and we won the podium. And
Every time, I know.
And yeah, 9 wins of those. So we had a few retirements, which hurts. The 99 with BMW, the biggest lead I've ever had. Then 2007 with Dindo and Alan, where we lost the wheel going down to Indianapolis at high speed. Poor Dindo was in the car at that time. It was 4 or 5 laps after a pit stop. And there we were already 3 laps ahead. So we lost that one too. So that's 16. Then there was one race where I didn't get in the car. And then there was when Alan, you remember, with the Ferrari, very early on in the race, he was leading. But the cars were so difficult. You had no visibility out of the car. Very tough. There was a BMW in 98. The first time there, we had a very low drag car. But we were retired because the wheel bearings were too dangerous, and they pulled the car out. And I was driving with Steve Sauber. He was staying in the car 6 laps after they called him to retire the car in sheer commitment, because we were running between 3rd and 5th at the time, but we were pulled out. So that was 18 starts. The rest was wins or podiums.
I'm just sort of counting all the near misses. It could so easily have been 11 wins at Le Mans, even 12, right?
Yeah, but Le Mans is very much a team effort. And you asked about it, team effort in the way of being with a team. It's all about wanting to help and wanting to feel part of the team. Because for endurance racing, that's something I think is what I try to help, or to make sure there is a good atmosphere around your car. So it's mechanics, it's engineers, and certainly all the drivers I've had. I mean, Michele, Stefan Johansson, then was Steve Sauber, Hans-Joachim Stuck, JJ Leto, Jörg Müller, Bila, Emmanuel Piro, Frank Bila.
It's a kind of who's who of motorsport, this list.
Who
was the fastest teammate you ever had at Le Mans?
Of course, light is good. So, I mean, they always said the perfect combination were Capello, Magnish, and myself. But if you look at it, we didn't win so many as we actually did with Bila, Piero, myself. We won 3 on a trot.
But why was Dindo, Alan, and you the perfect combination? On paper, at least.
Different personalities, different way of being. We were very tightly knit. We were still good mates. We had a great way of racing and very, very committed together. And I think we were all three very fast and very consistent.
How much are you on the limit in a race like Le Mans? Are you driving it like a single-seater in a Grand Prix?
You are full on the limit, but you have in the back of your head the importance of it's now. It's not like, you know, overshoot, going off or whatever. You can't allow that. So you have that in your mind. So the limit is there. And then it's even more tough because you have the importance of that one race. You know, there's only one race a year. So it takes a whole year to get to. So some of these setbacks, some of the failures you had at Le Mans, they tear you. They really set you deep. And that you feel when you're going for Le Mans. You feel the history heritage when you're there, no doubt.
When does the preparation for Le Mans start?
For the manufacturer, it starts from the first scratch because they want the car to be successful at Le Mans. And then they optimize for all the other circuits, even for the World Endurance Championship. And I think for the whole thing, that's how it goes. It always, whenever you go testing, it's a little bit in terms of, all right, we have a fast car now. Can it last? We need the reliability on these parts. We need to make sure that these tires, yeah, okay, here they go off a little bit fast. But at Le Mans, we can run normally. Tires a little bit softer as you cool down on the Hunedoara, down to Indianapolis, the longer straights, things like that. So it always plays, a second thought always goes around Le Mans. But we are always on the limit. There is the traffic situation in sports cars, which you never should underestimate, because you need sometimes, it's kind of good to know who's in the cars you're approaching, because you're passing 7 to 14 cars every lap. And someone in the straights comes quite easy. But sometimes there's two or three cars there in a fight themselves. There you have some time to say, oh, careful here.
And how much more complicated does everything you've just described get at night?
Yeah.
Passing traffic, visibility.
Yeah, they know you're approaching at night because you're constantly having lights on the cars. But at night, they will notice you. So in that sense, they just don't know where they.
So the
where
traffic's
we are
actually easier at night for those reasons.
In some, yeah, I would say so. It's easier to feel the trust that they will definitely know you are coming. No doubt about that.
And what about just the process of driving the car at night?
That's tougher, no doubt. There's more floodlight now than there was back in the day. The lightning on the cars has evolved, like everything involved in racing. That's a good thing about it, and even helped my eyesight towards my career, because at the same time, the light got better outside. The dim light on the cockpit in terms of the steering wheel, complexity of all that, you had to optimize. You always had to change the view of the apex, of the traffic, and sometimes to what you had to do on the steering wheel. And that became a little more and more. That was one of the reasons why I was, oh, now it gets a little bit, you know, when you have a few seconds, you feel like you have to adjust. So I would say racing drivers plus 50 at night, that's not a good idea.
Do you sleep during that 24 hours as a driver?
In the first years, I barely, but...
Like just the adrenaline?
Adrenaline, you're feeling there, you have the radio, you want to hear everything, but I did. 18 starts, I would say 15 of them, I got some sleeps, some more than others. But I would say an average, three and a half hours, maybe four.
It is a proper test of endurance, isn't it? For everybody in the team, actually.
Yeah, but you know, adrenaline is so lovely. So when you have it, you can do it. And then the week after, you are probably a little bit more tired, especially if you come away after a bad one.
Let's talk about Audi now. What was your reaction when you heard they were going to do Formula One?
I knew it at that time because it has been going on a little bit in the background. And of course, my role with FIA at that time, and I know the meetings that was going on, Sean Todd, those years, it was coming and it was looking very good. And at the time, sustainable was very important. That was a key word for Audi to Audi come in. And I think it was right time. There has been so many times when I was at Audi that there was times when we were linked towards Formula One or particularly the Volkswagen Group. So I thought now with this new regulation, the timing is right. And for sure, it's very special for me to see and to feel. I'm really happy for the progress they have already done, with the impact they have done.
And how would you describe the Audi way, of going racing? And do you think the way they won in sports cars is applicable in Formula One, or do you have to do things slightly differently in Formula One?
There's no doubt you have to do things differently in Formula One, and it's already been done. I mean, the way they have, obviously they have running it completely independent from Audi AG in terms of the merger with Sauber in Hinwil, and then making the engine facilities in Neuburg. That's built on the great Audi facility like we ended up with at that time. So I think they've done things right, and I just want to see them progress. And the way the impact they have done already, I think is very extraordinary. Two good drivers building on the teams, and now one of my sport car teammates is running it together with obviously Mattia Binotto. Have put him in place there. So it's there's a lot of emotion about seeing how well they are going forward.
Has Alan McNish approached you about a job at the team as well?
I don't think so.
The old drivers are coming back.
I don't think he has time, and he's doing a good job. Remember, he was team principal of the Formula E team. Since he put his helmet off and retired from racing, I had a feeling. He says he never himself had the feeling that he will go that way, but I always had the feeling. He's a great person, a great motivator. He knows the craft, he knows the business, and I think he's the right man of having, let's say, the genes of how we went racing in the sports cars back then, and he knows the DTM sides as well, all the Audi motorsport program under Doug Dolek at that time. And then you have Stefan Dreyer sitting head of the engines in Neuburg, and he's a big racer with a big heart going forward there as well.
Are Audi ruthless in the way they go about their racing? In that, you know, the stated aim is to be challenging for the world championship by 2030. Do you have every confidence that they will reach that target?
Yeah, yes, I have. But I have definitely you need to be more open about that in Formula One. In sports car racing, you probably not will have to be approached in the media after every session. So in that sense, it's a lot more media orientated sport, Formula One. Every session, you are going to be dealt with questions going in that direction. But in short, as long as they improve, every time they improve, it's going for the right target. I remain confident that it's the right people and they have the opportunity.
TK, I have so enjoyed this chat. Can we end it just by talking about F1 2026? Can we talk about Kimi Antonelli?
Yes.
Aged 19. Is he ready to win the world championship?
You're never ready to win the world championship, and in that sense, you're never ready, but you're doing it, and he's ready doing it because he's doing so well. Look how he has improved since last year. He also is, some drivers really likes these cars better, and this year he's doing incredibly well. Remember how he started the European season after actually have kind of breaking, he broke the lock, I would say, or what do you say, the key. He found the in Miami 2025 when he was on pole. And then he had that miserable European season last year.
Oh, 3 points from what, 9 races or something? Yeah.
This is not going to happen this time. The way he has approached on his racing this year, he's committed, he is confident, he's just lovely to watch. I hope that's going to continue. And at the same time, also the perception in terms of George is really on the top of his game as well. So it's an interesting internal battle there as well. But Kimi is just raised to that potential as what Toto Wolff and his team have seen a little bit earlier than others. And they are benefiting from that now. And George has to constantly deliver, not being unlucky as he has been a few times. And then we will see when the other teams are slipping in. Ferrari looks hot at the moment in Monaco. McLaren will come back. They're the constructors and world champion with Lando Norris. They also want to come back, and they are nearly there as well. And when do we see Max on the top step again? When?
Surely not too long. Actually, on the topic of Max, you're someone who's driven so many different cars in your career. What do you make of Max going and doing his GT3 racing on the side?
Yeah, I love what he's doing, and I love that. And I think we really have to, let's say, embrace that. And it's just nice to see. And I think it benefits the whole ecosystem. I mean, okay, if you like the Forest and Nürburgring, it's probably a little changed now. It has been seen by the most people ever during the 24 hours of Nürburgring. But I like that. I like Alonso when he comes to Le Mans and when he won a Le Mans. So big respect for that. And that's the same with Will Hülkenberg with Porsche.
Do you think driving different cars makes people better racing drivers? Do you think Max actually benefits his Formula One career by doing that GT3 stuff?
Yes, in generally you benefit. No doubt. But how much you can do and how often you can change, it might upset the things a little bit. But I think as a driver, a motivated person, human being, you should do what you would like. And like that word versatility. For me, the word versatility is the best word in motorsport, because you can use versatility about your car, about the situation, about the circuits, about the weather condition, everything you can use that. And you can jump between the series. And you can say, okay, I might be a little bit romanticizing, thinking back in the old days when people did that, when there was no sponsors on the car, things like that. But hey, I take that with me. I like that. And I like to see people who have the opportunity to do it. Please do it. It benefits the whole system about racing. The ecosystem about racing is only benefiting from each other. The pinnacle is clearly and deservedly Formula One, no doubt. Look where it is today. Unbelievable. But all the other categories are doing very well too.
TK, thank you very much for your time. Great chat.
Pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
What an extraordinary conversation with a true motor racing legend. Tom thinks versatility is the best word in motorsport, and it's certainly the best description of his ability behind the wheel of a racing car. Formula One's loss was sports car racing's gain, but it's wonderful that we still get to see Tom at Grand Prix in his capacity as a TV pundit. Thanks for your time, TK, and I'll see you again soon. Well, that's almost it for this week, but before you take your headphones off, why not check out another official F1 podcast? F1 Nation's review of the Barcelona-Catalunya Grand Prix is out now. And on the same podcast feed, you'll find a deep dive into the race start procedure on F1 Explains. And if you head over to the F1 YouTube channel, you can watch all the latest episodes of F1 Beyond the Grid. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. But for now, thanks very much for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out. Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.